Welcome to the Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast, produced by the History Network. If you have any comments or ideas, email editor@ancient-warfare.com. And for other discussions, check out the Ancient Warfare Forum, which you can find a link to at www.ancient-warfare.com. You can also find all the History Network podcasts by going to www.thehistorynetwork.org.
Hello, everyone. We're back with an Ancient Warfare podcast. It's been a while, but we've had some technical difficulties, Christmas, and difficulties to get agendas aligned. But to make it up for the long wait, we've got a guest this time. So apart from the usual crew, Lindsay Powell, Murray Dom, and Michael Taylor, we're joined tonight by Ian Hughes, author of a book about Belisarius, and more on the way, I think. And tonight we're discussing Rome and its eternal enemy, of at least late Rome and its eternal enemy, the Sassanid Empire. I think we, in the issue, mentioned that the sources are quite problematic, so perhaps that's a good point to begin with.
Maybe just to frame it, 212 AD is sort of a big moment for Roman history, in the sense that Dio Cassius stops writing, sets down his historian's pen, thinks the Roman Empire is doing a-okay. So that's sort of the end of our big major literary history that kind of covers, you know, most of the High Roman Empire. And then until Ammianus Marcellinus actually picks up in the 360s, we don't actually have any good reliable Roman historian covering that period in between. We have really, for the most part, the scriptores, Historiae Augustae, or sometimes called the scriptor Historiae Augustae, depending on whether you think there were many or most people think there was just one scriptor. These are incredibly unreliable. Some people have compared them to tabloid history. Some people have compared them to Robert Graves-style historical novel. That's all we have for the middle of the period, which is maybe why there was so much gnashing of teeth, just trying to figure out the basic facts of what happened.
It's practically impossible, isn't it? Because the scriptor, whoever he or they were, there's stuff in there which is apparently factual, and then there's people in there that appear to have been invented. Every now and again, archaeologists find a coin or a stelae or something and say, oh, there's another emperor just appeared. When was he from? I think part of the problem is that the period itself was so confusing that unless you had modern technology, it would have been a nightmare to try and keep up with it.
Mm. Well, let's shine the light then over eastwards then. What do we have for the Sassanid Empire, which I'm looking at here runs back to 224 AD to 651. Is it as lacking in evidence for that area of the world too?
I think that the difficulty is that the Eastern material is also very, very confused. There's very little of it, largely because the Sassanids were overthrown, and although some of their architecture and that type of material has been influential, the literary histories have all been practically ignored. You're always falling back on the fact that we don't have very much for any of it. This is why, even when you're talking about 5th century, you're still relying for some evidence on Procopius in the 6th. Going earlier, it's even more fragmented. And that's for the Romans. There are the odd thing, there's History of the Armenians by attributed to Sabaos. And there's, don't ask me if I'm pronouncing this correctly or not, Khazar Parpeki's History of the Armenians. And there's Moses Kuranatsi, who's also written a History of the Armenians. But apart from that, there's not that much. The difficulty, I think, has been that a lot of it is either written in Syriac or a language which requires specialists to translate it. And until recently, the specialists haven't been willing to put in the amount of effort and time to actually translate these things so that they become widely available. So it's been mainly, for want of a better phrase, extreme specialist. That's been a real problem for anybody wishing to study the period.
And certainly maybe the most dramatic and maybe important Sassanid Persian source that we do have is the rock-cut inscription that celebrates Shapur's victory over the Romans. And it's sometimes referred to as the Res Gestae Divi Shapuris, sort of takeoff of the of Gracchus Augustus, but it does have him describing his campaign, and it actually is the closest that we have to the Persian side of the story. There's one kind of famous line where he says, you know, Caesar lied and did wrong to Armenia. Certainly this is the Persian take on this kind of diplomacy that's going back and forth between Rome and Persia. And of course, there's actually the image of poor Valerian groveling before Shapur. And certainly this is a very Persian take on what certainly is one of the great Persian triumphs of these various exchanges.
The trouble with things like that, of course, is just the limited amount of information you get out of them. No real dates, no specific chronologies, no political overview of what's happening.
We lack a historical overview as we have it in the previous centuries.
Again, apart from the Roman thing, there's very little going. And even for the Roman historians, once you get away from Ammianus, it becomes so fragmented. The trend goes from written history, nice chronological narrative of some shape or form, to the chronicle. And of course, the chronicle by its very nature is just very, very brief, very, very fragmentary, and specifically aimed at what the chronicler was wanting people to know.
So to coin an expression by a former American defense secretary about the known unknowns, so we know what we don't know, kind of, but we do seem to know some things. We know that there were periods where there were intense struggles between Sassanids and Romans, and we have names of individuals. For the purpose of this podcast, other particular campaigns that are particularly well documented that we could get our teeth into?
There's not very much at all. You get to 286, 300, and then there are large gaps where you know there's something's happening, but you've got no idea what it is. You don't know if it's small raids, large raids, minor invasions, peace, everybody living happily on the eastern frontier. You've just got no idea. Except for the odd sentence here and there.
Yeah, you can really see it, especially in the second half of the 4th century and most of the 5th century, just by knowing the author who made this chronology and also knowing that he had to keep it within one column. It was difficult for him. You can just see in the obvious selection of what we know, what we don't know, where the gaps are. So we have a reasonable idea of what's going on in the 3rd century and first part of the 4th. And then indeed, Ammianus stops after 363. And what we have then is epitomes and references here and there until Procopius picks up again.
But the crucial date of 410, Rome falls to Alaric the Goth. So there's a very definite switch then to Byzantium, you know, the Eastern Roman Empire then takes over as being the focus of Roman intent, I would think.
Yeah, all of the histories appear to have been written from an Eastern viewpoint, the ones that have been lost. With very little in the West, except for the chronicles. Mm. And of course, all of the Eastern histories appear to have been lost, mainly focused on the Western chronicles or later abridgments of the histories written at the time. And this has always been the greatest problem in studying anything from about 400 AD onwards. It is so difficult to even establish a basic chronology for things.
Yeah, it's also got that whole issue of, because we only have a sentence, you suddenly spend, you know, an entire chapter discussing a sentence, whereas in a more verbose period, you've got, you know, we've got all of that book discuss this campaign, whereas you're taking a sentence of Eutropius or a sentence of Festus, then you're comparing it to, you know, a section of Eunapius or a section of Zosimus, then you've got an allegorical line in a poem by Claudian, and you're having to extrapolate that out into not only a campaign but also a chronology, and then you have the issues of, well, what was their agenda as a pagan apologist or a Christian polemicist? You've then got the issue, well, it's poetry. You know, there's all those problems that come into the interpretation of single words, let alone sentences.
Yes.
But it's, you basically come to an end very quickly. So it's frustrating because you've only got these candle flickers of light, and then everything's darkness again.
Yeah, just to make this observation, I think it's interesting that having just written about the period of the first century BC AD about Germanicus, but the same problem is also even in that first century period, because you rely on, for example, Livy, and then suddenly Livy ends at 9 BC, and then you've got these perioeci, which basically cover the years before that, because these are basically the tags that would have been on the end of the scrolls, effectively. That's all you have, is the one line. This volume covers, you know, the death of Drusus and the other. And now we have about, I think it's 10 years, where we have no idea what happens at all, because it's collapsed completely in book, what was it, 55 of Dio Cassius. Yeah. Interesting, it gets, this discussion, I think, gets at the heart of a lot of what the problems of discussing and understanding ancient world history is. We've sort of fallen into a bit of a trap in thinking we know a lot about it, but the truth of the matter is there are great areas where we don't. And I think the smart reader, like the people who are listening to the podcast, when they read the magazine, are made aware of those issues.
A wonderful example is probably Trajan's reign, Trajan's campaigns in Dacia. We've got an issue coming up soon. Or his war in Parthia. It's just as Murray said, just bits and pieces and very fragmented parts of Dio Cassius. At least then you know how reliable he is, which is usually pretty well. But this is just sort of a problem, but then enlarged. We're not talking about a 15-year period where we have all these bits that you just have to connect together to make some sort of narrative. But you have 50 years, or maybe even a century where...
Yeah, you can have a century where you've got three sentences, and then you've got nothing to check them against. You've got nothing to say that they're accurate, how they fit into that century. It's a bit of a nightmare.
Well, what you just said about the period, you know, in Augustus' reign, at least then you have, well, not masses, but certain quantities of epigraphy. The same with Trajan. I mean, for the Dacian campaigns, at least we have his column. And you can use other sources to supplement your limited literary sources, but what do we have in inscriptions from the East? I mean, archaeology is more problematic there, and the epigraphic habit seems to have not necessarily petered out, but become much less widespread after the 3rd century.
As you review each period, you deal with the hand that you dealt with. So in the 1st century, we're lucky. We have a lot of volumes, for example, of writers like Cassio, or in the case of Livy in the earlier part, or Tacitus. But of course, you approach them with kid gloves, because you know in the case of Tacitus, there are certain political or narrative agendas that he runs. And the same thing you might say is also true of Cassius. And then as you move forward to later ages, maybe you have to rely more on archaeology, because that's all you have, and you make the best you can with what you've got. So I guess the question I would have is, okay, so the literature isn't very strong for the period. Does the archaeology tell us something then that will get us a knowledge and understanding of this period?
Well, the archaeology is all down to personal interpretation. Diocletian Limes on the eastern frontier, people were arguing about the purpose of it for years, saying it was a linear defence, or is it a thin defence to stop people from breaking through? Although you can find items on the ground, trying to fit them into a defensive or offensive pattern, you're limited by the modern assumptions about what the Romans or the Persians should have done, not what they actually did. And that's always going to be a major limitation. It's impossible to go back from the present day and say, this is how they did things, because the mindset is completely and utterly different. The books I'm writing at the moment, I'm finding more and more that it's a common assumption that something that happens, for example, in Britain, is known about almost instantaneously in Constantinople, when in reality it could take months for that information to travel over there. And unless the information was sent by a very reliable source, it can be garbled, and therefore people don't know what's happening. An example of that is Valentinian and Valens. There was the rebellion of Procopius, 365, in the east. Word got Valentinian in the west that Procopius had set himself up as emperor, and that was all it was told. He didn't know if Valens was dead or if it was a rebellion. He didn't know what was happening. And a lot of modern-day commentators have questioned why Valentinian didn't go east to support his brother. And part of the problem was he didn't know what was happening. How can you react to something unless you're sure of what's going on?
And well, isn't that why you had your Augustus and your Caesar? Because effectively what you had to do was you would delegate the authority to deal with problems at the lowest level within the command chain, because you know full well it's going to take that length of time. So the guy on the spot is given the Imperium Maius, or whatever is the equivalent at that time, you know, in order to be able to act in the name of the chief, but of course is responsible for the consequences of that.
And the problem with that, of course, is that if you've got an individual in control who isn't exactly dynamic, then things can easily get out of hand very, very quickly.
We're down into leadership choices at that point, and that's a reflection on the individual emperor or the commander-in-chief, isn't it?
And indeed of the Persian emperors. The Sassanid Empire is huge, and they've got the same problems that they have in the eastern half of the Roman Empire. In this late period, who do you place in command of which area, who is going to be able to do the job necessary, and who you can rely on to fulfill that function? If you're a Sassanid charge, do you put your best commander in the east where the Hephthalite Huns are threatening you, or do you put him in the west against the Romans? This is always something that people forget. It's the sheer distances and the fact that messages have to travel. It can take months for information to come through. And even then, like I said, you're relying on the people passing you the information to actually be passing you accurate information.
Every day that the messenger's on the road, I mean, the situation's already changed.
And it's also one of the things that makes the overviewing history like we're used to complicated, because we've got usurper A, rebellion B, emperor A not in a good relationship with emperor B, blah, 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 blah. Whereas the reality would have been that no one else knew about what was happening necessarily anywhere else other than their local area. What we see is this huge disorganization. What would have been the situation would have been far more piecemeal. You know, and for centuries they talk about the glory of the Roman Empire being restored, whereas we look at it now and say, well, it had no chance because look how messy it was. Whereas throughout the Byzantine, you still get this idea of Roman greatness that they talk about. We view that as kind of hubris because we're looking at this incredibly and continually shrinking state, whereas this seems to be a mindset, you know, which goes all the way back to Brutus, you know, Rome is wherever I am free and all that sort of stuff.
But, you know, Murray, that's an interesting thing. Again, that comes to the core of the historian's role in writing history. And I read recently a fascinating book about the late 30s and how Hitler was viewed by the establishment in Britain. And again, they actually thought the guy was a good one. And they thought that, you know, when he settled down his chancellor, he'd be a very good chancellor of Germany and the world would be a fine place indeed. And it was actually Churchill was one of the few people who said, actually, this man's absolutely, you can't imagine how terrible. But they were working through the prism of their own day, using the information sources available to them. Yep. We stand back from that, and we're able to sort of see very differently the lay of the land. And of course, as Ian and yourself have pointed out, depending on as the information that we get changes as each new discovery comes along, we keep rewriting the histories. But the issue has some very good stuff about, for example, the Battle of Kalinkum. I mean, so presumably, can we trust Procopius to have written a good account of that battle, do you think, or not?
Belisarius is defeated. And I think he has written as honest an account as he can without dropping Belisarius in it. There's two or three places where there's different sources saying, actually, Belisarius did this and it was wrong, or I think the main one is where Belisarius is claimed by Procopius to have gone back to the infantry once everything started going wrong. And he stayed with the infantry, and the infantry held off the Persians and allowed the rest of the army to retreat. And, you know, this is Belisarius doing his best, honest. And yet there's another source which states that Belisarius fled to the river. He just ran away. You're always left with the knowledge that the person that's writing it, you are just getting their one viewpoint a large amount of the time. Except for these little scraps, you don't get any contradictions. There was a review of the battle afterwards which cleared Belisarius of having done the wrong thing. In other words, Belisarius had set out for his battle, he'd been beaten, but he hadn't been incompetent and he hadn't been negligent. He'd done his best. I think we can trust most of Procopius's account.
Yeah, so the question is, then, when we look at the wonderful battle plan there, for example, that's based on Procopius's version of events, yes?
Yeah, it's the only description of the battle from which you can actually piece together any form of battle plan whatsoever, really. And that is all based upon his. And it's quite interesting to note that he states that in the early battle of Dara, Belisarius saw what the Persians were doing and countered them. Whereas at Africam, he didn't see what the Persians were doing, and therefore the Persians won. And I think that brings up something which I've been thinking of more and more recently. Everybody states that the Romans, if they invaded Persia by the southern route, it was all flat and it was all low rolling hills. And it was wonderful terrain for the cavalry and no good for the Roman infantry. But if the Romans invaded via Armenia and came through the northern route and down through the very hilly terrain into Persia, they tended to win. It's always been classed as being the hillier terrain is detrimental to the horse archer. And although I'm thinking that that still holds true, I'm wondering if part of the difficulty that the Romans faced against the Persians was the sheer tactical flexibility of the Persian army, especially as at Callinicum, they fielded an all-cavalry army. Mm. If you've got an all-cavalry army on the flat and the enemy can't see what you're doing, you can move your reinforcements to where you want and attack the enemy unexpectedly, like at Callinicum. But if the enemy are able to take slightly higher ground, they can see what you're doing, and your flexibility is to a large part negated.
It's ironic because, you know, one of the great things about the classic Roman army is its flexibility, that you can vary your formation and according to the threat. But I think the big issue that comes about through the invasion of Persia or Sassanid Empire is that there's a weight of tradition on your shoulders. You can't just go in and beat them in the best way. You've got to beat them in a way that anyone else who tried had failed to do, to show your superiority. So they do use the same, you know, invasion route as a way of showing that they were better than their predecessors. That border becomes, you know, you need to make an effort there, but we don't expect a great deal. So when you're looking at Eutropius and Festus's epitomes, for instance, their heroes are the ones who are aggressive in the East, not necessarily the ones who win, but the ones who actually show some get up and go. And their villains are the ones who simply give up or cede territory without any fight. So there's this whole quandary of tradition that's sort of stuck on top of the Roman commanders.
Why does there actually have to be this warfare between Sassanid Persia and the late Roman Empire? On one hand, we wouldn't be surprised. There are two big, sophisticated empires, and they abut each other. So we'd expect, given kind of the anarchic state of affairs, that there would be conflict. But it seems that on one hand, there is a mix, at least on the Roman side, where our sources are terrible, but I guess maybe they're at least a little better, a mix of Sassanid Persia being a really legitimate threat that can project power into the Roman East and actually cause quite great destruction, that Shapur can come in, sack Antioch, carry off tens of thousands of people as slaves, defeat Roman armies. So on one hand, a sense of legitimate threat, and then there are also just being these ideological issues that Murray's brought up. The emperor gains sort of political capital by going and fighting the Persians as the Greeks had done and Alexander had done, and it's another way for the emperor to cement or secure his status. It certainly seems to be a question of why there actually has to be so much warfare in the first place.
I think that's history, isn't it? When they first met each other in the kind of first century BC, didn't the Parthians and the Romans come to a quick mutual understanding of peace and tranquility?
It goes back basically to sort of Crassus and Pompey and the great generals out there. And it was Marcus Agrippa negotiated, we think, a peace
with, I forget the name of the day, but it was Azabanis or one of those people. And then during Augustus's reign, yes, they certainly had a peace which was able to be extended under Tiberius. And it does seem to be that there was an understanding there was more to be gained by having a truce and not taking shots at each other. But that seems to be lost at some later period. And I have to interpret it this way. There was more interest in the Rome-based leadership, if you will, to face off opponents on the northern frontier, Germany, Dacia, around there. And when those frontiers have settled down again, now we've got the problem of large numbers of troops you've got to do something with. Is warfare, in a sense, a function of how much idle labor you have and an emperor on the make? Or is it just a case of they need to build their capital, as you've phrased it that way? I think when the Western frontiers have been dealt with, it's not possible to conquer Germany. Dacia's been conquered. We're not going to go any further. The only place left is, guess where? The East.
Maybe in support of the idea of Sassanid Persia is a really legitimate threat, it does seem that the Sassanid Persians, who, you know, the Parthians are a dynasty that claimed descent from these nomadic warlords that had been based up north and had been this old Persian territory of Partha, and the Sassanids are an Iranian family with Iranian supporters, and they do seem to be a little more ideologically motivated towards kind of reconstructing the glories of the old Achaemenid Empire. So it may be possible that the Parthians, who ran things in a very decentralized way, were a little more laissez-faire, not as much of an aggressive threat to Rome's eastern provinces as the Sassanids are, who, you know, by the 260s are striking hard. There is something different between the Sassanids, the way they see the world, the way they run their state, and the Parthians.
The difficulty that the Sassanids had is that straight away they claimed that they were the heirs of the Achaemenids. And as soon as they claim that, in effect, they're claiming part of Roman territory. And as soon as word of that gets across to the Romans, that's a threat. So the Romans have then got to have troops on the eastern frontier ready to fight against the Persians. And I think the Persians in charge have very little choice but to actually do something against the Romans. Because once you've claimed that that territory is yours, if you then don't do anything about it, you lose face. And I think as well, a large part of the problem for the Sassanids, from what I've gathered, is that financially they weren't as well off as the Romans by any stretch of the imagination. So a lot of the tensions between the Sassanids and the Romans was brought about by the Sassanids demanding subsidies, especially to guard the Caspian Gates. They wanted the Romans to help pay for the troops stationed in the Caucasus that were going to stop the Huns from breaking through, as they had done in 395, wasn't it? And this would have been fine, and I think the Romans paid it for a few years, until we found out that the Sassanid emperors, for internal propaganda, were saying that these subsidies that the Romans were paying weren't subsidies, it was tribute. And of course, as soon as you say that, tensions begin to rise again. And I think the whole history of the Sassanid Empire and the Romans is one where tensions flare up and then die down again, based largely upon the political agendas of the Sassanid Empire, the political agendas of the Roman emperors, and the financial condition of the Sassanid Empire, because whenever they feel that they are very short of money, they ask Rome for donations.
Well, I'm looking at the first date in that chronology is revolt, 220 AD, revolt of Persians under Ardashir, and Ardashir rules as 224 to 41 against Parthia. So who is this Sassanid dynasty? I mean, are these people who have been disaffected by the Parthia, the Persians? Are they people that have come from another place outside? I mean, what's their sort of story that gives them the basis to revolt?
They are Iranian aristocrats. So, again, the Parthians are always seen as this outside dynasty that initially are a group of people in the Seleucid Empire. They're basically nomadic horse people. They set up shop in what's, again, then this sort of satrapy of Parthia. They take their name from the satrapy. And as the Seleucid Empire suffers from internal problems, the Parthians expand and expand and expand. when Pompey the Great annexes the kind of rump of the Seleucid Empire, the Parthians have basically expanded to control most of Iran, most of Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, and that's when Romans and Parthians first have this kind of diplomatic exchange, and then eventually Crassus says, well, gee, wouldn't it be really cool for me to, just go mucking around up there? And of course, he's massacred. So those are the Parthians. They rule until about 224, I think is oftentimes the date you'll hear is the final overthrow. That dynasty is overthrown by, again, this native Persian Iranian dynasty, who, as Ian said, definitely thinks of itself as the heirs to the old Achaemenid Empire, and they are again kind of more chauvinistic in that sense, that they really think that we're going to take back what's ours. Although I guess it should be noted, while they are interested in some of Rome's sort of penetrations into northern Mesopotamia, they certainly never make any claim to conquer Syria, Egypt, Asia, I mean, any of the what had been major parts of the Achaemenid Empire. So the amount of territory they actually act on is very small, mostly just, burning the garrison town of Dura Europa. They certainly don't actually seem to enact any kind of plan of conquest by any means.
And I think you've touched there upon one of the biggest problems between the Persians, the Sassanids, and the Romans. A lot of what happens is based around internal demands. The Sassanids are this new dynasty. They've come in and they claim that the successors of the Achaemenids. They don't have much option but to then claim all the old territories of the Achaemenids back. So therefore, their propaganda is always going to be, we've got to beat the Romans. We've got to get our lands back. For the Romans, you're always going to have the problem that ever since Caesar, if not before, the Roman emperors are supposed to go out, either in person or via their leading generals, and defeat the enemies of Rome. And there is no bigger enemy than the Sassanids or the Parthians. Going off and beating a German tribe, whatever distinction, is fine. It's good, and you get your name of Gothicus, anything like that. You can go and invade Britain, which is the last great, in effect, invasion. But what most of the Roman emperors would have secretly hankered for was to defeat the great enemy, which was the Sassanids or the Parthians. Mm. And that's always going to be a source of friction between them. Am I right in saying that Julian's invasion of Persia was brought about by a Persian attempt to invade the east whilst Julian was engaged in the civil war with Constantius? And once Julian had won the civil war, the Persians sued for peace because they knew then that the Romans could now come and attack them. And Julian refused their terms of peace and carried on his invasion. And again, that's for internal politics. That's Julian wanted to prove that he's the heir of the great Roman emperors and, of course, Alexander. He has to go and attack the Sassanids to really give himself that air of invincibility.
But it's also interesting in the sense that when you look at the Eastern invasions or the incursions or the raids, they generally always coincide with either a northern frontier rebellion or uprising or the death of an emperor. The Parthians and the Persians seem to be very well informed about what's going on internally in Roman politics, so that when there is the change of emperor or a particular rebellion going on somewhere else, they take that opportunity to seize a bit of land or make an invasion. Like with Julian, when that threat is disposed of, that's when they try and make everything okay again. It's a very well-informed politicizing of these things, so that invasions tend to follow on from politics.
Because what we were saying earlier about was the problems of communication. So relatively, it would be fast, but it would be a year, 2 years, surely.
Yeah, you're talking at least 6 months for anything to happen.
But of course, it doesn't really matter because the news travels that long, and then the Roman army needs to prepare to respond somewhere. And by the time they move away, maybe that's just it. Maybe they notice that, the border is less strongly held. Might be a good opportunity.
So you can then amass your troops on the frontier and just wait to see what happens and wait for news to come back about any events going on, and then you can invade.
It is kind of convenient to maybe look at the Roman Empire at this time as
having to deal with three separate events or threats simultaneously. Namely, there's always going to be a threat from tribal peoples living along the Rhine and Danube frontiers, and I guess I should extend that all the way up to the frontiers of Britain, so a long northern frontier, which takes a lot of troops to garrison, and there's always kind of this low-level threat. You're going to have to deal with first the Parthians, then the Persians, who are a more sophisticated state-level threat, and then probably there's the most dangerous threat of all, which is civil war, which if this period breaks out all the time. And it seems that there's for Rome, there's actually a really unpleasant coincidence in the 3rd century, in that in 224, you have the Sassanids coming to power, a much more aggressive Persian state. That's coupled with the Goths actually organize a Gothic confederacy in the same decade, in the 220s. So you're going to have more well-organized barbarian peoples up to the north. And then with the end of the Severan dynasty, all political stability pretty much leaves the Roman Empire, and you have basically 50 years of almost nonstop civil war. And I imagine that it's you know, always there's this attempt to balance the three, but in many instances it means that Rome is simply too hard pressed. It can't fight the Persians, keep the people of the north out, and you know, engage thousands and thousands of soldiers in civil wars. So my guess is in some instances, possibly that the frontier is just always being held in a very thin manner at this time, just because there's always troops getting shuffled either, you know, for one reason or another to deal with these three things that are, again, almost all going to hell simultaneously.
But have you noticed that in that period where everything went wrong simultaneously, as you said, the Persians, the Sassanid dynasty that had just come to power, they made very few attempts to conquer large areas of territory. And even when they did, the forces of a small city out on the fringes of the desert was able to hold them back. The Palmyrans held back the Sassanid Empire. And I think to a large degree, that speaks of the Sassanid Emperor's acceptance of reality. They had an empire. It was large. It was relatively powerful. But it was nowhere near as powerful as the Romans. No matter how many times the Romans sacked Ctesiphon, there's very little attempt by the Sassanids to go any further than Antioch in retaliation. You know, they knew that they couldn't take out the Roman Empire, even the eastern part.
I think you're right. And I think in many ways, both empires behave very similarly in the way that their aggression is structured. A few emperors think otherwise, but the Romans, for the most part, don't want to conquer Mesopotamia. They just want to go burn Ctesiphon, take a bunch of loot, and then march back with your loot and glory, and okay, we're done. We just beat the Parthians / Persians. It's not about territorial conquest. And, you know, the Roman Empire probably couldn't even govern that kind of territory if it wanted. I think that's Hadrian's conclusion when he withdraws the Roman army from Mesopotamia and says, you know, Trajan had this terrible idea to make this into a province. This is two rivers too far. So the Romans, I think, they can temporarily project power to Mesopotamia. They can trash Ctesiphon yet again. They really don't have the ability to hold it. And you could say that it's the exact same thing with the Sassanids. They love going in and trashing Antioch and looting it, but they probably themselves don't have the ability to either conquer or hold the Roman Near East in the long term. I think in some ways both empires are kind of at the limits of their power.
Yes.
They can rush up against each other. They can occasionally take a little poke at each other, but this isn't really ever a case of the Sassanids invading Italy or equally the Romans invading Iran. It's neither of them has the kind of ability to project power really much past Iraq.
To be incredibly cynical, on the one hand, you've got the whole idea that in order to look like you are the inheritor of the traditions that both the Romans and the Sassanids are claiming, all you need to do is go and be aggressive on that frontier. You know you're not going to conquer the territory. You know you're not going to make a province of it. You're going to either sack Ctesiphon or you're going to sack Antioch at best. So you've got this whole, I have been a true Roman. I have been the, you know, the inheritor of this great mantle, or you've been the inheritor of the Persians of old. So on the one hand, you've got propaganda and you're achieving the glory that you're claiming by being aggressive without having to do anything more. Secondly, you've got the fact that civil war loot is kind of tainted. Even if you know you know, that your opponent is wealthy and their troops are wealthy, there's something not right about looting fellow Romans. You've also got the fact that the northern frontier loot is not particularly glorious, whereas on the eastern side, you've got this whole idea that there's a great deal of wealth to be taken by looting cities on either side. And if you then retreat, then the wealth will build up again, and so in, you know, a generation's time, you will get loot again. So you sort of get that, and the shuffling of armies, and the especially the emperors who are raised by armies, there seems to be this whole kind of, I'm now going to go and be aggressive somewhere where I can reward you, you know, my supporters with loot.
So, Murray, what you're saying effectively is like the old joke about the bank. Why do people rob banks? Because that's where the money is.
Yes, yes. But you only rob the bank. You don't try and, you know, roll the chairman of the board. You go and choose you choose the branch rather than the board itself.
Very good, very good. Except, of course, if I understood this correctly, the Sassanid Empire itself was a sort of federation, was it not, with sort of regional governors and sub-princelings and so on. Is that right? Because of its vast landmass, it had to work that sort of way. It had to be broken down into administrative units too.
I think this is where we don't know as much as we'd like to about the Sassanid Empire, and not being an expert, I think the general sense is it's much more centralized than the Parthians had been. But at the same time, yeah, you can't rule a huge land-based empire and be particularly centralized. As we've mentioned before, the communications by land in particular are so slow and inefficient. You generally have to have subordinates with a degree of initiative and a modicum, at least, of decentralization. And, you know, certainly even the title of the Sassanid king, which is the king of kings, I think it's Shah Rashah in Persian, does imply that in some instances there are client kingdoms that are under him that give obeisance and pay tribute and maybe running their own show. He's just the king of all these smaller kings in some instances.
That's correct, until the 540s or thereabout, isn't it? The reforms of Khusraw. I find it slightly intriguing that in the 6th century, especially in the early 6th century, both the Romans and the Persians start to try and change things around a bit. The Romans, up until at least the late 4th, early 5th centuries, were still the traditional infantry supported by cavalry. You know, in the late 5th, early 6th, the chronology is not secure, they start changing to a cavalry-based army. And I think a large part of that is due to the fact that the Western half of the empire is gone. Although the Eastern emperors claim nominal suzerainty, I think they must have realised that had gone. They were no longer going to get anywhere over there unless they sent an invasion force. Therefore, their main two frontiers of problems were going to be the Danube and the Eastern frontier. And I find it odd that they changed to a cavalry-based army, kind of matching the Persians, at roughly the same time that Khusraw initiates a series of reforms, which effectively creates a kind of prefecture system for the Sassanids, where you have got, I think it's four areas, the east, the west, the north, and the south, run by one subordinate. And it's only something I've started looking at recently, and I don't think many people have attempted to explain it. The fact that the Romans start to change to look a bit more like the Persians, whilst Khusraw is trying to change his empire to reflect more a centralised kingdom, reflecting many of the administrative policies of the Romans. The drawing of a cavalryman on page 21... The Persian cavalryman, the photograph, I should say, of the Persian cavalry on page 21, it probably looked a little similar to the Roman cavalry that were being transformed into the effective arm of the Roman army. I don't think there's any archaeological finds of helmets that have been pierced for a facial coif. But apart from that, I can't see that much difference. A mail shirt of some sort, possibly arm guards, a bow, and that's almost exactly the same as you've got here. for the Romans.
Yeah, I did notice that.
I noticed as well that neither have adopted the bow used by the Huns, even though the Huns had been knocking about for 100, 150 years by this time. You know, the asymmetrical bow has not been adopted by either the Sassanids or the Romans. They've stuck with their own technology, which they no one trusts, and yet the Romans have changed things. And it's something that isn't usually picked up on. I've not seen it picked up on anywhere else. They seem to be starting to try and copy the best bits of each other, because the eastern half of the Roman Empire is no longer kind of weighed down by the traditions of the western half, which is, it's gone, it's collapsed.
Well, my understanding, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, is that both sides, you know, are in some ways heir to kind of an old Iranian tradition of heavy male armored cavalry, whether it's the Romans might call it cataphracti, sometimes known as in slang as clebinarii or boiler boys, because all the armor makes you quite hot and boiling inside. But my understanding was that in some ways, yeah, both of them adopt this form of sort of Iranian style heavy cavalry simply because it seems to be effective, and admittedly has also been around for some time. It seems that it may have been adopted first by the Seleucids around the 200s BC. That's one of the things that starts to define the fight more than the kind of traditional Roman infantry.
Yeah, but it's strange when you look at the Titiae Dignitatum that the majority of these cataphractarii clebinarii units are in the west, and they're not being deployed against the Persians. They seem to have this belief that they can win against the Persians without adopting Persian tactics until the west is gone, and they're just left on their own in the east. And if they have experimented with the clebinarii and cataphractarii earlier in the west and found that they're good against barbarian infantry, then it's possible that once the Eastern Empire is on its own, they come to an understanding that actually, if they did convert now to the entire army away from infantry and more towards cavalry, then they would still be able to cope with the Danube frontier, because the barbarians coming across that frontier would still struggle against them. But they might also be able to cope on a more even par with the Persian armies and be able to defeat them at their own game. There's a passage in Procopius, unfortunately, I can't remember the precise reference, where he compares the two and says that the Persian cavalry and archers rely upon mass bow fire, whereas the Roman cavalry archers rely on accuracy and power. So it does make me think that possibly the Romans have adopted some of the tactics and equipment of the Sassanids, but their main source of influence for what they were trying at the time was actually the Huns.
I think we'll leave it at the Huns. They will make a nice topic for another discussion and perhaps another issue of ancient warfare sometime. So I'd like to close by thanking Ian Hughes, of course, Lindsay, Murray, and Michael. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast, produced by the History Network. If you have any comments or ideas, email editor@ancient-warfare.com. And for other discussions, check out the Ancient Warfare Forum, which you can find a link to at www.ancient-warfare.com. Don't forget, you can also find all the History Network podcasts by going to www.thehistorynetwork.org.